Never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. A world dismissed as conspiracy by those who want to keep its secrets hidden. Exposing the dangers, denials, and deceptions. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. If it's Tuesday, it's Tuesdays with Stan. Stan Deo is our very special guest tonight. Can't wait to hear what he's got to say before we get back into it. I want to thank everyone who has sent emails with respect to our proposition. Can we pull off a no-fly week or a no-fly day or, you know, some sort of protest that we saw InfoWars do some time ago, and we participated in that where, I think it was over Thanksgiving weekend, where we just said, no, we're not going to fly because of the oppressive tyranny of the TSA, the ridiculous nature that we are subjected to their tyranny. Can we do that? And I want to thank everyone for chiming in via email. Just go to HagmanHagman.com, click on the Contact Us form, and share your thoughts, because perhaps we can make a difference. But I'm kind of testing the waters here, asking you folks, the listeners out there, if we can pull this off, if we can be successful at it, because otherwise it could be, you know, certainly used against us, and they can say, oh my goodness, these people are weird, and, you know, not that I'm afraid of that, but certainly we want to be as successful as possible. So your ideas welcome. Studio at HagmanandHagman.com. With us, of course, is Stan Deo, and don't let him fool you. He had accurately predicted an earthquake through data, research, and evaluation. We're going to let Stan talk to you about that.
And, Stan, welcome back to the Hagman and Hagman Report. Go to standeo.com, people. Click on the show images link to the right-hand side of the microphone on the right-hand side of the website. It's great to have you back this week. It's been an eventful week, at least in the earth-shaking realm.
Yeah, it has, guys. It started out with a couple of Richter 6s, a little bit above Richter 6s, and, you know, it was in the states of Afghanistan and Vanuatu and Burma. Burma had almost a 7 and 6.9. But in the middle of the one in Vanuatu, just after that occurred, and the Afghanistan one, they got a surprise in the southernmost island of the Japanese islands, main island anyway, at Kyushu. And they got this 6.2, I think it was, the first earthquake was 6.2, but it was a very powerful one. It is an area that doesn't normally see earthquakes. So we pay attention to earthquakes that arrive on the scene, especially when it's close to a tectonic plate border, which that one is, or was. And then there were a number of aftershocks, and in a couple of days passed, and then bang, you know, they got a 7.0, a bigger earthquake there, within a few miles, you know, before the first one hit on Friday. So I started looking at, so a lot of other people trying to figure out what was going on, because this was not only earthquake of that magnitude in Japan, in a place that it doesn't normally occur, but it was the third in a series of Richter 6 plus that occurred within less than a week. And it went on after that. We saw one, you know, we saw the side, in the show notes page, on the second row on the right-hand side, I have, if you click on that, I have a thing I created on USGS showing where these big earthquakes occurred and some of the smaller aftershocks in the last 2 weeks. And on the left of that image, you'll see the earthquakes in order by magnitude, and of course the date is given underneath each of those. And then on the map, you see the yellow dots and the orange dots are the most current, and the white ones are, you know, back toward the end of the 2 week period, and between 7 and 14 days back. Now, what we see from this is the continuing increase in larger quakes on the western side of the Ring of Fire. Now, this has got the scientists kind of concerned about this. There are some that are predicting 4 Richter 8 earthquakes if the current conditions in the Ring of Fire persist. Now, 4 Richter 8s in a year is definitely above the average of 1 or 2 that we normally get. So they're kind of making a very bold prediction scientifically that this might be happening. The Japanese scientists are also concerned that it might be explaining the arrival of a new fault line that is running parallel to the tectonic plate border, which is not in itself unusual because that occurs over in California, you know, and parallel faults, all kinds of parallel to the San Andreas fault. But anyway, they are looking at this, trying to figure out if there are going to be more faults and more earthquakes as they move north. Well, I've been working on something. I am not ready to release it yet. I'm still testing it, but I thought I found a way to get back into forecasting some of the major quakes. Now, when I say major, a Richter 6 or better, the smaller quakes don't show on the data I'm testing at the moment. It's just too subtle an image change, and it's hard for me to pull it up to see accurately. But as Doug and Joe were saying, I was playing with this on Thursday and Friday, and I came up with a little signal at Kyushu, which is, of course, where the Richter 6.2 hit on Friday. And I thought, well, that looks like there could be an earthquake there. It's an unusual one. I'll make a note of that and see how it goes. Well, sure enough, 6.2. So I did the next day's analysis on that data and to see if there was any more happening in Japan. Well, sure enough, it showed that the pressure for the next big earthquake there was moving to the north side of Kyushu Island and up, you know, in a line parallel to the plate tectonic border, which does indicate that Kyushu Island is being kind of divided by this new fault line. Now, whether it will split the island in half or not, as some people are saying, I don't know, but it certainly does indicate the presence of a new weakness in the crust in our fracture zone, which is partially connected to some of the known fault lines underneath the island, according to the Japanese data. Now, okay, that's fine. I thought, well, that's pretty serious. A lot of people have been hurt. Homes have been hurt. People are scared. Now, what's up the line? What's up toward, let's say, Fukushima, where all the damaged nuclear reactors are? Fortunately, these earthquakes down on Kyushu weren't close enough to an energy plant, a nuclear energy plant there, to worry about it damaging it like Fukushima. But when I looked north, I found something that was, well, you know, if the routine is working correctly, it shows a buildup of pressure between the plate tectonic border off the coast of Fukushima there, and between that and the Fukushima reactors. Now, if that goes off, that could be some serious business. Now, it hasn't reacted yet, which I would expect it to do if it was following the rest of the predictors I've been using. It's drug on, and I would have thought that we'd have seen action by now on what I saw there. However, not to be. I haven't put this up on the website yet, as I say, because I'm still testing it. But to give you an idea, Kyushu Island, the signals I got on that would have been like about, let's say, one-tenth, one-fifteenth the size of Kyushu Island. The signal I'm getting off of the Fukushima coast is about 25 25% bigger than the whole island of Fukushima. That's how big this signal is. So I see other signals like this, thermal anomalies going out to sea, and they're not near the fault line. But to have that kind of a sea surface temperature anomaly over the fault line is concerning. So let's keep an eye. I'll probably post this up on the site. I've been toying with whether or not to do it because it's still not, in my opinion, a reliable predictor. And see what happens up off the coast of Fukushima. Can you imagine an aftershock of that one they had in 2011? You know, maybe a 7.9, an 8, something like that occurring there in the same place. Is it going to release more polluted water or what? I don't know. So anyway, well, that's my current state.
That'd really ruin your day, you know.
Yeah, and I'm sure it would release a lot more radioactive water and particles into the Pacific Ocean if that were to happen.
Yeah, well, I can't see why it wouldn't. I mean, it's just, you know, think about it. I mean, you know, it's just not, it's not going to hit there and not release something back into the ocean there. And these poor people, well, I'll tell you what, they're certainly being tested with all this stuff.
Yes,
anyway.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll just, while we're talking here, I'll probably fade off occasionally, but what I'm doing is putting that image of what I was just talking about up on the site for the show here so people can look at it. And I'm doing that as we speak. But there were several other things that I looked at this week. A rather interesting one is the first picture I've got of Prince Mohammed bin Salman, that we talked about as one of the possible Antichrist candidates, without his turban on, or, you know, with just normal hair and stuff like a normal person in a interview he was doing the other day. And look at that guy and understand that you may be looking at the Antichrist. Here's a guy that's 31 years old. He's deputy crown prince. His cousin, I think it is Mohammed bin Nayef, N-A-Y-E-F. And so around the palace, they call the crown prince, which is one rank above Solomon, they call him MBN for Mohammed bin Nayef. And they call Solomon MBS for more BS, no, for Mohammed bin Salman. And I keep getting back to the fact that he's gaining so much support in the Middle East from at least 39 total Arab countries that are primarily Islamic, in forming a new Arabic Union, you know, which is what the al-Nusra Front want as in opposition to ISIS. They wanted to have a consolidation or a confederation of Arab nations to form an Arab bloc, but not make them under one caliph or a caliphate like ISIS wants. And, you know, Salman wants to get rid of the caliphate clowns too. But I think in the end, if he is the Antichrist, he's going to go ahead and become the caliph or the king of a union of Arabic states. So you'd have MBS is heading the Arabic Union. MBS, three consonants. Arabic Union, AU, two vowels. Put the two vowels in between the MBS, MABUS, 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 whatever.
Right. Yep.
And it starts to fit. And he is just so popular that if he goes for, you know, ruler of the world eventually in some set of circumstances, he won't have time to just manage Saudi Arabia and Aramco. And so what are they doing at the moment? They're offering to sell off half of Aramco. He's happy to let his cousin Mohammed bin Nayef become the new king when King Solomon dies. He can run Saudi Arabia while MBS is running the world. You see, it all works out. He could be the prince of the covenant, even though he has more power than the king of Saudi Arabia. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I watch him because, I mean, he said that he could ramp up, I think, by the end of the year. He could, and even before then, he threatens to do it. He could add another 1 million barrels of oil production to the Saudi input to the OPEC per day, which would mean another 365 million barrels of oil a year he could flood the market with if he wanted to and drive the price of oil down, of course, creating chaos across the world economy. And he may well do it. This would be a tremendous financial weapon, which would bring a lot of the countries of the world in the West to heel if they want to keep the economy going. So he's got a tremendous weapon there, and he's setting himself up as a military, political, economic, easily trained as an attorney, and a legalistic Muslim Arab. And he's just winning the popular opinion. They don't vote him in, but he's winning the popular opinion of the 30-ish age group, young people in his country and other Arab countries. In fact, I think he's probably the most popular, most favorite personality in the ruling families of the Middle East. And the fact that Saudi Arabia, most of it, is sitting on top of what was Atlantis originally, got to make you wonder if some of the genes didn't seep out of the sand and get a hold of the Saud family, and then we've got a new Atlantis forming under them. But I'm just being silly, but you know what I mean.
Actually, I'm not so sure that's really all that silly, considering the implications. Well, I mean, looking at the bigger picture here, and of course Atlantis and the significance of Atlantis and the writings of Plato and how it figures into the bigger picture. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, well, very good.
I'm going to talk some more on that Atlantis business here, something that perhaps I don't think I've mentioned on the air with anybody, but we'll do it here. It really wasn't important what I'm going to harp on here until I discovered that the Arabian Peninsula is Atlantis. And once I had that, pegged, then what I'm going to tell you makes more sense. You know, I used to work for a group. Oh, by the way, look on the show images page. That earthquake thing, the model I was using to predict, is there with some yellow circles around Kyushu and Fukushima. Anyway, in the early 70s, when I was recruited to go down with Dr. Teller's group and to research advanced flying saucers and that kind of stuff, anti-gravity, one of the sites I was told about that the organization had was the most secure site in the world other than those under the ocean. And this site was in the empty quarter of the Arub Khali, in the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula. Now, it's 120 miles outside Riyadh in the Jabal Tuwaik mountain range. And if you look at that at Google Earth, and then look at anywhere else in Saudi Arabia, Google Earth, the rest of Saudi Arabia, the images are nice and crisp when you zoom down to the ground. In that area, there's a rectangular set all along the Jabal Tuwaik, which is highly pixelated. In other words, very low resolution, so you can't see what's on the ground there. Well, our base there, where they had assembly areas for the smaller flying saucer craft and probably aliens as well, or, you know, fallen ones, in that area there, if you came within sight of that base heading toward it by air or by land and you weren't one of our craft, you were shot down and killed immediately. There was no questions asked. They didn't ask for credentials or anything. If you didn't come in the approved way, then they didn't even let you get to the gate. And it's hidden in the side of a mountain there at Jabal Tuwaik. Now, that site is right kind of almost in the middle of what was ancient Atlantis. And you got to wonder if that site that we had then was working with the return of the Sumerian supermen, you know, that Linda Moultonhouse spoke of. She heard the general saying in the Pentagon that the Sumerian gods, little g, had returned. And, you know, that was going back after I was even in the program, so it was much more recent than being in the program. So I think that the fact that they've blocked out that area in the Jabal Tuwaik. In fact, anyway, if you got Google Earth, you can go and you put one of those little rulers they have there. You can put one dot in Riyadh, right in the center of it, and make a circle 120 miles in radius. So that would be like 240 mile diameter. And where that circle crosses the Jabal Tuwaik south of Riyadh is where the base is. And you'll be let into a secret about where one of our very, very secret bases was and may still be. In fact, the reason reason that we were able to even put it there in such a remote place in Saudi Arabia was that there was a sheikh who'd been up to some naughtiness, and he was blackmailed into letting us have that access in his territory and stuff. Otherwise, it would be known to the ruling family what he'd done, and that would be a bad deal for him. Anyway, it was a very long personal story with him, and that's how we got that base. The things you don't know. But that area is very important, and I looked at the name in Arabic for the empty quarter. Normally we say Rub al-Khali, you know, like that, but it's Arub al-Khali, and it's Arab, ancient Arab, the Khali, and they say that means the empty quarter, but it's also a derivative of the name Arab or Arab. And I think this Arabic union that Prince Solomon is putting together is certainly going to succeed, and it's an effort to unify the Arabs of the world, the countries, into a new strong power block in the world. And the way it's headed, I think they're going to make it. And another thing, since he does not like ISIS, they're a small people, they're not a country. And we know the Antichrist is going to come to power with the help of a small people. And I'm wondering if by defeating them, or either by defeating them or by getting them to change their objectives and join him as a small people, the world will rejoice if he puts a stop to ISIS and the terrorism. And the terrorists who want this Arab caliphate will join with him and be tickled to death to serve with him. It's a rising star. They'll join with him. So it might be that he uses the ISIS-type terrorists, and al-Nusra and some of those who are the opposite to ISIS, but still terrorists, to form this world government eventually. I don't know how the Pope is going to fit into this, but he's certainly helping by calling for a world religion.
Indeed. Any compromise of Christian principles, or biblical principles, I shouldn't say Christian, but biblical principles, to me, that's the quickest route toward a one world religion, obviously. And Stan, just a recap with respect to the religion, well, the three monotheistic religions. It's my belief that the Christianity, Judaism, and Islam will have to be made illegal, or at least marginalized, diluted, to accept the a common savior, if you will, or a common God. Is that what you believe as well?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
There's going to have to be compromise to form this global religion, and that's what the Pope is pushing for. Lord only knows what that compromise means. I guess one of the obvious things would be, God is God to the Jewish community. God is God to the Christian community, and a lot of subsects of that. And Allah is the same God, and that's the lie they're going to put across.
Exactly. And I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it amazes me too, the influence of people like Oprah Winfrey and some of the celebrities and some of the mega or pastors of the mega churches here in the United States. And even as others across the UK and in Europe, through their individual movements, have really played their roles very well to set the stage and fertile the ground for this this one world religion, which, as you said, has to take place in order for the Antichrist to take over.
It's not just this Pope. It's the Vatican. I remember 1978 holding a pamphlet in my hand, a color pamphlet down in Australia, telling the meeting place for the association to form a global religious equality in the planet, and it was run by the Vatican then. And every year they've been having meetings. I think they have a website and stuff like that. So it's been an ongoing situation, no matter what Pope was in the chair at the time. It's a long game they're playing. It runs across generations, and not just across decades.
True.
Yeah. Hey,
go ahead.
You see, where North Korea is asking for outside help because they've got Mount Paek 2, I think it's called, on the border between North Korea and China. It looks like it's about to erupt and really be a big problem to them. yeah, sad. Well, good luck. The sad thing is probably the North Korean people themselves are just really quite normal people, but their leadership is, they're crazy. They're just really crazy.
That's an understatement.
Do you see, Stan, speaking about North Korea, what's your assessment of their nuclear program, which you've been able to analyze, research, analyze, and verify on your own? Do they have miniaturized nuclear devices? Do they have the capability of launching them? Do they is North Korea a threat, I guess? And if so,
Think to a degree they are. They're more like the wild card in the pack that China or Russia might use to trigger a confrontation on a larger scale between the United States, Israel, and Russia and China and various associated allies. They could supply Russia, China, Pakistan. Somebody could supply the North Koreans with what they need as far as delivery systems, like the S-300 or something like that, or the type of nuclear device that they need. And they could launch it. They could launch it off the deck of a merchant ship off the coast of New York, you know, in international waters, and it could make an EMP or a direct meltdown of New York. But either one, they could do it before we could stop it. Some of these things people don't realize. You can just mount it on the deck of a ship, a cargo ship. The container door on the top cargo container opens up, and out comes the nose of the missile, and poof, it's headed for New York at, you know, it's almost at sea level. You can't stop it. It would come in, and it would either detonate over the New York area or Washington, or it would go up into the atmosphere like we know, up 150, 200 miles, and detonate there and make an electromagnetic pulse that would absolutely destroy all of our digital, you know, electronic systems that weren't hardened, leaving only some military systems and some fortunate systems that were placed offline somewhere and shielded working. Now, that would do more damage than an atomic bomb.
Right. And we've got no way to track. For example, and I'm trying to really simplify this in my own mind. Let's say North Korea, you know, the guy really goes fully off his nut, loads up some sort of missile on a container ship, sends it off to the United States. There's no surveillance ability of the United States or any Western country then to track the movement of a nuclear type of weapon, or is there?
Oh, you mean like before they even open the doors on the ship?
Yeah.
I don't know. If we do have something that good, I don't think they'd make it public. We have detectors. If you get reasonably close to a concentrated radiation source, you can peg it. But if it's in the international waters and traveling, then you're looking at either a submarine comes up underneath it and does a check, you know, or puts a little cork floating out there with a detector on it, or somehow they've managed a way to measure electron density around that ship from orbit. They do have things that do total electron counts, things like that, and it might be that they can read the ionization around that and deviation from the background norm, that they might be able to track it. Let's hope so, but, you know, I don't know.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, it was just something I was thinking about. But so what you're saying is, yeah, North Korea is indeed a threat, and they do have the materials, and certainly they could be aided by other countries and be used as a proxy. And we should be taking a look at this and taking it seriously.
Yeah, and certainly on our West Coast, too, with the quake threat. We have our own nuclear reactors there, some of them sitting on, even one retired one, I think, is sitting on the old fault line. There's just been a lot of stuff pushed at the public about the big one will come. It's definitely going to come. Not sure when, but it will come. And, you know, hints to prepare and how to survive a tsunami going inland in Oregon or something, you know, how far up the valley you got to get. And, okay, we remember a few years back here, a couple years back, when FEMA ordered a bunch of, you know, meals to feed a million people for 2 or 3 days. And you start putting these things together with all these quakes happening on the west side that are bigger now in this little cluster. And you start to wonder, is it soon that the big one's going to happen? And is the big one going to be a big earthquake, or is it going to be Yellowstone, or is it going to be both, or is it going to be New Madrid, or is it going to be all three? because the FEMA preparation was to feed those people over in the New Madrid region, and people immediately assumed, for a New Madrid quake. But it might be for people escaping from clouds of ash from Yellowstone. It might be from people escaping through the mountains of California over into the interior and looking for some place to live, eat, stay, or whatever, when the earthquakes start breaking up the west into islands. I'm looking. I mean, I'm keeping an eye on the west coast as best I can with this kind of crude new method to forecast the quakes. And if Tim Berkeland is correct in his assumption on the quakes being triggered by, say, full moon, and moon at perigee for Earth, closest point to Earth, that might occur, you know, next month. Second week of May, I think. I'm just trying to remember. I looked at it the other day. And let me just check on it here. New moon will be on the 6th of May on a Friday. So I'm going to be looking the first week of May very closely at what the earthquake signals are along our west coast and particularly up in the northwest, to see if we're getting any indication. If we are, and we go into that perigee of the moon, I tell people to be very prepared as best you can for an earthquake and tsunami after that.
So I shouldn't plan on any vacations to the West Coast beaches Friday, May 6th, based on...
Yep, cancel our, extravagant beach vacation.
As long as people understand what we're saying, it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, you know, because we don't know for sure. We're just trying to guess as best we can.
Yeah. Well, the confluence of events. I mean, looking at it, it's always good to be prepared, folks. And it's, tongue-in-cheek indeed, but my goodness, you know, let's look at this realistically and have an intelligent discussion about it, and that's what we're doing, so.
Yeah.
All right.
It's no time to do, you know, panic preparation stuff. It's time to, if you haven't already started doing it, to prepare for various types of meteorological or geological or even astronomical events that could affect, you know, your power in your area and your water and food supply and stuff like that.
Right. Indeed. Okay.
Anyway, yeah, that's that. I was reading in the news here that I'll just read you the headline. Mystery body possession epidemic sweeps through Malaysian schools, causing teachers and pupils to collapse while being pinned down by evil spirits.
I saw that.
Did you? Okay. Now that is that meaning that the veil between our worlds is thinning and they're starting to poke through more easily?
It's a very real possibility. I was wondering what could be the cause of this. You know, in recent weeks, I've seen headlines like exorcisms continuing to rise, demonic possession, you know, on the rise as well. But to see this in a localized area so pronounced here, it is mind-boggling. And, what do you make of it?
Well, I think it's quite possible, especially to be that widespread of like 100 different cases being reported. They say that something pinned them down as a heavy thing on them, holding them down to the ground. My eldest boy, he's the third boy in the chain, Nathan. When he was young, his bedroom was just down the hallway from us, and he woke up a couple of nights screaming and fighting something, and it was this dark being, he said, like, he could see it up on the wall and then down on his chest, and it was fighting with him, and it was heavy on his chest. And, you know, it was pretty much a great concern to us, but as he got older, it didn't happen anymore. But he was fighting off something that we prayed about and shielded him about even back then, and that would have been, in the 80s, mid-80s, I think, somewhere in there. Early 80s, let's see, 80. Yeah, probably the mid to late 80s, 1980s. But having done that and had it happen in the family, I can certainly relate to what these people
Any relation to sleep paralysis? I mean, what your son went through.
No, I don't think that. I know sleep paralysis is one thing. He was able to move and swat at it. He wasn't paralyzed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It was real enough. And so it might have been because of the work I was doing at the time. I was working on the first book about the Garden of Eden in Atlantis in 1989, the Vindicator Scrolls. And, of course, now that I've updated all that, and certainly we feel the pressure here, not of evil spirits, but of just, financial and physical pressures on both of us that let you know that you're doing something that Satan doesn't like.
Interesting, and I do believe that we're seeing an increase in the or as you put it, the rending of the veil between the dimensions. Would CERN have anything to do with that? In any way, could it have anything to do with that?
Look, I don't go there to start with, but it is possible. Okay, they are playing with very strong magnetic fields. And they're trying to punch to a parallel universe in small scale, and they might make a big scale by accident or otherwise. Certainly the statue of that Shiva and stuff out in the front does make you wonder what their real purpose is. But where is it in the scripture about that? It's in the end times about the veil thinning, or and people, men's heart will fail them for fear of things coming. Whether I don't know whether that applies to that or not, but there's a scripture I've been trying to find about that, about the veil, the evil things across the veil. It might be when the bottom of spits open. I don't know. Anyway, I'll look it up on these days and find it.
Interesting.
And talk about that.
Interesting. Yeah, but we are definitely seeing a rise in what I would call a demonic possession, or at least a demonic presence, is becoming more overt. Of course, the rest of the star talks about the dirtying of the air, and of course we're seeing this, and I think it's I don't think it's by accident, but I'm glad you pointed that out.
Yeah. This is not earth shattering stuff, but last week I've also spent some time down on the ground in Google Earth map trying to find the path that Israel took when they made the exodus from Egypt over to Mount Sinai, which is not in the Sinai Peninsula. And I remember back in, 1988, I think it was, I'd found some military maps that hadn't been confiscated down in a library in Australia at 1 to 100,000. And on the maps, I found several things that indicated how the fresh water was made out of the salt water when they were in the Exodus, and the fact that Mount Sinai might actually be in the southern part of Saudi Arabia underneath Jordan, and go on the coast of the Gulf of Aqaba. Anyway, I'd done all that, and I shared the map with a guy named Ron Wyatt. He said, look, can I have a copy of that? Because we talked by phone. I said, sure, I know you're going over there and doing research. And he took it, and he decided, as have some others, and I think erroneously, that the Red Sea crossing didn't occur on the Suez side of the Sinai Peninsula, that occurred on the Gulf of Aqaba. Which would have meant that the trip out of Egypt would have taken longer, and all kinds of things don't fit time-wise. But he reckoned he found a chariot wheel at the tip of the Gulf there, right where it joins with the Red Sea. And because of that, he figured, well, okay, this is where the Pharaoh's chariots were buried, in the backwash, from the water that closed in on them after Israel crossed across. So I decided, look, I'm going to get down at ground level here, and I'm going to trace, mile by mile, in fact, in some cases, foot by foot, the altitude of various mountains and valleys, and where people would camp, 100,000 to a million people would camp with animals and stuff, where they get water and that kind of thing. Now, if you look on the show images page at the third row down, in the first image on the left, and click on that, it will give you an overview of where I traveled on Google Earth trying to fit time-wise and thing-wise what they discovered, what they saw, where the exits occurred. Now, the pyramids are where the yellow pin is on the left. That's, you know, the plaza with, you know, Khufu and you know, the three or four pyramids are all together there. At first, I thought there was going to be a problem with the exodus because I thought, well, goodness gracious, how did they get all those people and animals across the Nile from the pyramids if they were working on the pyramids and were camped over there? But apparently they weren't. They were camped on the east side of the Nile, and the Nile ran between them, and so the workers were taken by boat over the to work on the pyramids, but then they were brought back, you know, after a period of servitude or whatever. So I started my little red line path from that area there, Goshen, I think, something like that anyway, where the Exodus trek started, and they left, and they went down, and they went to a place where they camped on the Egyptian side of what they call the Sea of Reeds, which is a shallow part of the Suez branch of the Red Sea. And they were trapped, in essence, by Egypt chasing them in the chariots with their army. And they were hemmed in there from Egypt on the north side. Is it the north? Yeah, north side. And then there was this place called Migdol that their backs were to Migdol, and so they were trapped between there, the water of the Reed Sea, and Egypt, or the Egyptian chariots and the Pharaoh. Well, if you look on that map where Migdol is, and you get out your Google Earth and dive down, you'll see there's about a 2,800-foot mountain rise there, which goes down to the shore and forms a pocket where Israel could have camped underneath Migdol, or in the shadow of it, if you wish. And they would have definitely been trapped and killed by the Pharaoh if that that pillar did not fall down over the top of them all night long and blow the water apart there so they could pass on dry land. Now, what you miss if you don't get into Hebrew is that when that, like a tornado, a very big one, dropped down over that area where Israel was standing and camping, it did what tornadoes do today. And that area, by the way, is known for what they call typhoons or typhoons, which were tubular-shaped tornadoes, what they called them in the old writing. The air in the middle of a tornado, even today, is moist and it's warm, and it comes down the tube, right, splashed to the ground, and it forms a vacuum in the spinning wall, the thin wall of the tornado. So when it said that Israel could not reach the Egyptians could not reach Israel during that night, it's because Israel was right in the middle of the stationary tornado that God created, and the wall between them, they could see each other kind of dimly, you know, off and on. But if they tried to put a weapon or an arm through that, it would have ripped it off or sucked it away. So both sides were protected from, you know, contact with the other. Of course, Israel was protected from getting annihilated, really. But anyway, there they were. And as the hot air, it was probably drier than our moist air is over here when we have a tornado, but the hot air all night long came down and parted the shallow Reed Sea and dried the ground so that, you know, ox carts and various other things they were using to carry their goods and animals could walk across on dry ground by the morning. It even tells you that the hot, dry wind came from an easterly direction, which gives us an idea of which way the twist of the tornado was doing on the outside edge. Anyway, they crossed there, and as they crossed with this tornado sitting stationary over the top of them. When they got to the other side, the tornado thing just kind of dried up and left, you know, it moved a bit, and it let Egypt and their chariots come after them into that dry ground of the Suez region there. The tornado lifted up, and the waves came in and, you know, killed all of the Egyptian soldiers. It formed a collapsing wall of water on all the sides, picked them up in the air, and threw their dead bodies back over on the Egyptian side so they didn't come over onto the Sinai Peninsula, and none of them survived. Now, that's where the crossing of the what they call the Red Sea in English, but it's the Reed Sea in Hebrew. That's where that occurred. And you see the red line they turned And they walked. They marched down. Marched down the coast there of the Sinai Peninsula southerly for 2 or 3 days, and they hit big lake of water. Everybody was thirsty. They complained to Moses, "We can't drink. There's salt water in these ponds. You know, the bitter water ponds." And that's when Moses turned to the young men and said, "Go and find me some big tree limbs and about this shape and size, and bring them here. Now, take these big trees and throw them out into the middle of the lake, and it will turn that salt lake into fresh water." Well, they did that, and where the logs went in, bluish fresh water welled up and filled the whole lake and turned it into a freshwater lake. Now, in the map that I gave to Ron White, I explained to him, I said, you can see there's a wadi, an under sand river that comes from the snow mountains on the peninsula there, of the Sinai Peninsula, and they form an inversion water lake. In other words, the fresh water comes down underneath the salt water blowing in from the Red Sea or the Sea of Reeds, and it forms a heavier than regular water layer of water over the top of the fresh water, and it's called a salt water inversion lake. So when you break that inversion layer by throwing a heavy object into it, it starts a cascade of the heavy salt water dives down into the fresh water underneath and pushes it up to the top. And that was the 3-day bitter water event that gave them the fresh water. And then I had to trace through there down to where the palms and the 12 water wells were found, and they sojourned there for a while and caught their breath and got strength to go on for the rest of the journey through the wilderness of Sin, which is where that red line goes across the Sinai Peninsula. Anyway, and they did that, and they went on over. There were two pathways I could see that they could take to cross over at Eilat, or, you know, at the top of the Gulf of Aqaba. Two would work, one slightly longer than the other by a few miles, but I traced each of these. I went down and said, can cattle come down through this pass here, or is it wide enough, and that kind of stuff. I made it just like I was Moses, trying to find a safe place to take my people through on reasonably level ground, or at least not chunky, rocky ground, and where there might be water. Anyway, that's the path I found there. You're looking at a couple hundred miles, between 200 and 300 miles of this path of the Exodus. Now, there, when I tried to find how you'd get up into Medea, which, as you'll see in the drawing there, it's where Moses' father-in-law lived, and where Moses spent 40 years with his wife, you know, Jethro's daughter, and he helped with the sheep for his father-in-law. There's only one way to get up across the mountains there with, you know, a million people and livestock and whatever, and that's down toward the top of the Gulf of Aqaba. Now, there's one way. There's a second way, which I found still just a few miles north of there. Both of them lead to the same place, to a little valley in between mountains and surrounded by mountains there, and that's where I'm pretty sure that Jethro was camped, and that area is where his tribe was. And that was where old Medea was, M-I-D-I-A, Medea, in the old records. Now, if you look southerly across that, there's a mountain range or small range of mountains between where Jethro lived and a fertile plain down in Saudi Arabia today, but in that time it was just a fertile plain where you'd have to travel, you know, 30 miles or so to get to it, but and across some hard country, unless you figured out a clever way to get around some of the mountains, which I'm sure Moses did. And it said that Moses used to feed his father-in-law's sheep across the mountains, you know, at the backside of the mountains in this fertile area. And I found that fertile plain in Google Earth. And I went to the rim of it, the high rim on the south part, and I stood there like I was Moses on the Google Earth. And Digital Deo was there. And I stood there, and I said, all right, what did he see? Where could he see from here that was a big mountain and it could have a burning bush and that would attract him to get away from the sheep to come and see God? And that's where the line of sight, yellow line, goes to a dark black mountain, which is a pair of volcanic cones that are not active now. But the Bedouins call it the Burning Mountain, which is volcano in Bedouin talk. And that was probably the real Mount Sinai. And from there, I mean, even Ron Wyatt took the maps, and he found one area, which I think I found the same area, where it's a long trench from a lava formation east of the Mount Sinai there, where the volcano was. And this area is deeper than the other long furrows of lava there, and it's covered over by sand in the middle of it. And it's probably where Korani's sons died, where the earth opened up and swallowed them when they were abandoning the Israel. and get out. Well, I think that's, we found a place there where they were buried. And Ron said he found, and some other people, tourists, have also, they found the rock that was cleft in two by Moses striking it and where the water sprang up. So this area, I'm pretty certain, was where the majority of the Ten Commandments and the dealings with God on Mount Sinai and the burning bush, that occurred in southeastern Saudi Arabia today, where I've got those pins on the map. If you want to see what Moses saw, go to the third row right image and click on that. And the yellow pin shows where Moses would have been standing on some little ridges, and he would have looked over to see the burning mountain, which would have been next to Jabal al-Laws. But the burning mountain is just called the burning mountain, so there's not, I don't know, any map reference to it, but you can see where the line goes and how, what he was looking to see over in the distance, what it attracted him to go and talk to God.
So this is scientific confirmation. Of the Bible.
Yeah, definitely. That's what I'm about. That, the Garden of Eden, Atlantis, which would be the fallen ones in Genesis 6, and that whole thing. There's a whole missing chapter or chapters about what the Nephilim were called and where they lived and stuff. And I'm filling in those blanks with hard data that we're finding now in the Middle East. And it's just so fitting that Mohammed bin Salman looks like he's going to be the bad guy of this age, and he's coming from old Atlantean dirt, you know. And why? Why does Saudi Arabia say to the foreigners, you cannot come in and film, you know, you cannot come in and explore archaeologically and all these places that I've been doing with Google Earth. We don't even like for you to fly over, and I think they've convinced the United States and other countries that they're not going to be able to image and show on Google Earth to the west of the southwest of the Jabal Tuwak range. I was telling you about where our base is. So there's a reason that they're blocking foreign archaeologists and flyovers to get a film. I'm sure that NSA is, you know, and the map agency have got the detailed images we want, but there's no way that they're going to share that with me. But it just all fits. It fills in gaps in our knowledge of history. And I was watching at lunchtime today on I forget the name of the channel, but it was talking about the dinosaurs being called dragons in the old writings. And it was from the Creation Research Group showing how, you know, various things prove that we have a young Earth, and how, you know, light and radiation and stuff, it used to travel orders of magnitude, like, you know, like 30, 40 million times faster than they do now. And that's why the aging of various strata and bones and stuff is off. And I just was so encouraged by that. It's just scientific proof that our established scientific view of the age of the Earth and the universe is just up to creek.
Interesting. Sam, we've got about 60 seconds left of our program. I can't believe you did it again. They're taking us for another hour. And what a fascinating way to end the program. I'm Absolutely. Looking at this, at that third row picture. My goodness. It's fascinating, folks.
Well, look at that third row in the middle one there. Just quickly, that shows you where that Midianite village or tribe lived. You can see the pathways that I picked through there. And I, you know, eventually we'll make the little data files available for people who want to go on Google Earth and track it themselves so they can see that. If you look right above that in the second row, second image, you get an Egyptian view looking toward the real Mount Sinai over, you know, way out yonder, and Migdol, that high place. And right there next to the blue water is where Israel was trapped by the Pharaoh.
Folks, the real Indiana Jones, actually the digital Indiana Jones as well. Visit standeo.com. Check it out. Listen to this program again, especially Standeo's presentation. What a fabulous.
We're at the end of the program, wow. Stan. It's been another week. God bless you and Holly. Stay safe, and thank you.
Take care. God bless you, boys. Bye-bye.
God bless you, too. We'll be back tomorrow. Have a good night, everyone.
This is the Global Star Radio Network. The Genesis.